You are listening to the Wells Tech Podcast, where we talk about technology that can serve the church and its work of spreading the gospel. Wells Tech is a part of the Podcast Network on Streams, the internet media site sponsored by the Wisconsin Evangelical Lutheran Synod. Join the conversation by visiting our podcast website at wellstech.wells.net. You're listening to the Wells Tech Podcast for Wednesday, January 20th, 2010. This is episode 115. Has printing affected the church? Time again for the Wells Tech Podcast. Welcome back, everybody, and welcome back to you, Sally. I guess it shouldn't be a welcome back. You're here every week, right?
Week in and week out. Week That's in, right, Martin.
Rain or shine. Snow storms, blizzards, ice storms. You've had all those this year.
That's right. And we've had frigid temperatures, 35 below we were. So happy to see some sunshine in our days lately.
Oh, you're sending sunshine our way finally.
Yeah.
Sweet. What's up with you?
Well, we had an interesting techie kind of thing happen this week. Always exciting when a new computer arrives.
So tech happened at the Draper home?
Well, it was actually at St. John's Church. Our church office got a new computer. And a cool thing, I thought, the widescreen flat panel monitor that came with it from Lenovo was packaged in a reusable bag, the kind you get at Target or Walmart or whatever, but big enough for a widescreen monitor. Okay. So instead of wrapping it in plastic, they put it in a reusable bag and attached a little note to it that said, "Love the Earth," and told you how much good they were doing by packaging it that way, how many trees they saved, and how much carbon, those
carbon
trees can...
Carbon units, footprint, yeah exactly.
So, just a little bit of encouragement from Lenovo and hopefully making an impact. And I thought it was interesting. I think we're going to see more and more of that as the days progress.
So what are you going to do with it?
Well, I already used it to go to the swimming pool with, so it's
the
great.
Swimming pool?
Yeah, got to get some swimming time in the cold season, don't you think?
Don't let that sun go to your head. Holy cow.
So, yeah.
Oh, good. Thanks for sharing. Appreciate that. We should probably get to one of your favorite show topics.
Boy, I can hardly wait. Chapter 3.
Chapter 3.
The Hidden Power of Electronic Culture. Great book. Really challenging me to comprehend what he's trying to tell me here.
Yeah, well, sometimes you got to read it twice, three times, and take it in context. The chapter that we're on, for those of you following along at home, and we would encourage you to do so, is Chapter 3 on Printing, The Architect of the Modern Church. Interesting stuff. He kind of goes back in time, right? To oral tradition, to kind of a tribal approach to sharing and remembering information, and then kind of moves through history and talks a little bit about the phonetic alphabet, how that has actually changed things in general.
Right. You know, I guess I had never really contemplated our alphabet system, but those symbols that we use as an alphabet really don't have a lot of meaning unless it's a learned meaning. He compares that to an ideographic writing like the Chinese alphabet that is based on actually pictures of the things that they're trying to convey with it. Mm-hmm. And so a single character can convey a whole word. And may, for instance, the example he gave was the word man. Actually almost looks like a stick man
right.
in what is used in the Chinese alphabet. So an interesting contrast there that I never really analyzed, but the fact that our symbols on the page really have no meaning unless we add to them abstract thought. We connect those symbols with images in our mind that tell us, what is being conveyed there. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he talks a little bit in that first section or first couple pages about the story of a tribesman who lived for many, many years in a culture that had no written words. That the way they communicated was obviously oral tradition, and they had nothing with which to record their words. So it was a very different culture. Then he was introduced to the written word, and it was like a whole new world opened up for him. And he kind of compared it to, you know, the modern day when the internet came into being and how that has significantly changed our lives. I know it has changed my life in many, many ways, and I'm sure yours as well. Then what? There was an interesting paragraph on page 48 where he talks about writing as technology. And sometimes you don't think of, when we talk tech, Sally, we don't think of writing as, we talk about the thing, the tools of today replacing, you know, writing. So the, you know, the tablets and the keyboards and the other input devices. But he writes, writing is not often thought of as a technology. We certainly don't consider it in the same league as the internet or cell phones. Yet writing is a technology because it depends on the use of special tools such as a pen or paper or brushes or animal skins. But more than this, it requires the human invention of a symbol system, one that you can take years to learn how to decode slash read and encode slash write. That does sound a lot like technology.
Absolutely. When you break it down like that and you analyze it in that way, it does make you realize the technology that's behind something that we take so for granted and is so ingrained in the life that we live.
Yep. And then a couple pages later, he kind of gets down to the real nuts and bolts of this chapter, where he says it may appear, when he's talking about this Western thinking based on the phonetic alphabet versus Eastern and the character-based alphabet. It says it may appear that we've ventured a long way away from the church in this exploration, but understanding the distinction matters for us today. In our current culture, we are increasingly communicating with images and icons. We need to understand what happens to Western culture when we begin to communicate using images and logos rather than phonetic words, as in the case of, and then he uses the example of Nike, and Just Do It, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this kind of caused me, maybe this isn't the point I was supposed to be having these thoughts or whatever, but just kind of thinking about our congregation as an example. And we have a lot of people who are firmly entrenched in the written word, and that's sure. what they know. But yet, even my generation, and certainly those younger than me, have grown up with television. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in those formative years, it wasn't all about reading. There was a lot of imagery and things that were introduced, and our brains develop differently because of that, you know. And so we have a mixture here just in our little small setting, and that presents its own set of challenges as to how we minister to that mixture of people with those different perspectives and different backgrounds or brain development mm-hmm. patterns based on the written versus the imagery.
Yep. And you can kind of get a sense for where he's going at this point, because one of the key tenets of the book is that the medium is just as important as the media, what the content versus the channel, that we shouldn't give short shrift to the channel, to the medium. And when you think of its application for the church, we're in an age where the church is beginning to use images, is beginning to use PowerPoints, and going back to, you know, what he would characterize as Eastern thinking, character-based communication methods and methodologies. And what implication does that have? So kind of to back up his point, he talks about four different things or emphases that have come about as a result of this phonetic alphabet, going away from character-based to this phonetic, you know, where characters are brought together with little or no meaning, and you simply memorize that they mean something. And so he says those four areas are individualism, objectivity, abstraction, and reason, as opposed to or in contrast to the medieval worldview characterized by an emphasis on tribal, mystical, and sacramental experiences.
So yeah, I could get a little intimidated when we start talking about all these different concepts, but framing it the way you know, you just did and the way Shane does in his book, and that we're going to take a look at the effect of print, you know, then it makes a lot more sense that these kind of things are at play or are being imposed on us because of our print-oriented culture.
Right. So these four primary ways in which printing created the modern church, he goes into a little bit more detail. So first of one was print made us more individualistic. And he writes, prior to the written word, a person's identity was completely bound to the tribe. The notion of the individual didn't exist. Because writing introduced the notion of the autonomous self, printing obliterated tribal bonds and profoundly amplified individualism. And the rationale that he gives is that when you read, you're doing it by yourself. You're not dialoguing. It's a totally an individual experience. And when you read, you are kind of cocooned in your little world. And then he says, this isn't all bad, however. One of writing's greatest gifts to us is the invitation to self-reflect or self-reflection. It created new spiritual practices such as personally reading scripture, times of solitude, and prayer journaling. By contrast, oral cultures lack the ability to gain distance from themselves or others, which leads to a spirituality that is nearly void of self-reflection and the intimacy of a personal relationship with God. So very interesting. Then he kind of goes later on, which he kind of proves his point even further, where he talks about his college days. He said, in college, my faith was nurtured in a distinctly conservative modern context. He attended university in Fort Worth, Texas, and he vividly recalled hearing a famous local pastor speak about Christian discipline. We all sat with pens and notebooks in hand, furiously scribbling down his every word. He finished his talk with the following statement, I've never met a godly man who hasn't had a quiet time every morning. Most of us in the room found that to be a reasonable and worthy goal and nodded in affirmation. In this view, the life of faith can be distilled down to daily quiet times, individual time spent reading scripture, journaling, and praying in an effort to get the right thoughts in your head and live a moral day. Over time, I've come to see a basic flaw in that viewpoint. Of course, these disciplines are immensely valuable for a life of faith. The problem is not the practices themselves, but rather where we rank them. In this case, these highly individualistic disciplines were placed above everything else as the primary means to discipleship. The pastor's teachings and my enthusiasm for it expresses one of the great consequences of printing's bias towards individualism. It leads to the belief that the church exists primarily for improving my individual relationship with Jesus. Faith then moves from being personal to being private, a shift that is antithetical to the biblical understanding of what it means to live as God's people. I thought that last section was really interesting. Faith moves from being personal to being private. And I think that when you look at the Bible and how God put people together, faith was never meant to be a private experience, but something that is shared. So I think he's right on there. Now, he's not always right on. I guess I'd have to say he's not always right on, I think, in some of his theology, which I guess we would expect. But I think in some of these areas where he's trying to say, hey, we ought to take a closer look at this, there's definitely merit to that.
The impression I got with this individualism section and actually with all four is that there's definitely a narrow road there. And taking it to the extreme is where you seem to get into trouble. Mm-hmm. And I think he kind of, pulls it all together at the end when we revisit some of the things we talked about in the previous chapters and the different looks at the laws of media or whatever. But it's almost like a slippery slope because, you know, that individualism can just go too far. But yet, as he said, journaling and self-reflection and all those things that the print allows us to do are good things. So.
Yep. And then the next one was objectivity, that the written word has led us to be, to this notion of of being objective. And that he says that isn't necessarily bad. I mean, it does benefit our faith. It's not subjective. It's not what it means always to me. But there is the sense that if you take that again to the extreme, then you rule out the application portion of what God's Word is and kind of sanctified living. So being too objective reduces the Bible to a set of kind of black and white sets of rules rather than content the Holy Spirit uses to work through our lives. I thought he made a good and a valid point here. In fact, he points to the fact that, and I guess I've thought of this in the past, you know, we have four Gospels, and they come at the same story, the same content from different perspectives, you know, one for the Jew, one for the Gentile, one a little bit more in a summary fashion. So he says the mere fact that the Bible includes four versions of the life of Jesus tells us that the subjective experience and interpretations have places in a life of faith.
Tells us that God valued that subjective experience,
right,
because
absolutely.
He put those words there for us. Mm-hmm.
And then he talks about print made us think more abstractly. And this was a little harder to get my arms around. And I'm just reading through a couple paragraphs here. He says, here again, this shift in perception and understanding caused the approach to theology and faith to become more abstract as well. Prior to the rise of printing, worship was centered on the concrete practices of the sacraments, like baptism or communion. But with the new capacity and enthusiasm for abstract thought due to printing, the pulpit began to displace the altar and sacraments, like communion or baptism. Preaching became the high point of the worship service in the modern Protestant church. Moreover, modern sermons became extremely abstract, lengthy, and dense. And he goes on to say that's not all bad, but the fact that that the sacraments, you know, which obviously the Lutheran Church holds in high regard, take on maybe less importance.
You know, it made me think maybe we as a synod are still a little bit more abstract than the rest of the world has moved away from.
Right.
And, you know, more systematic in our theology and that kind of thing. And not a bad thing to be that way. I couldn't help but think about children's books, and there's a series of children's books that we really enjoyed called Freddie the Pig, and they're from the 1930s and 40s, and we loved reading these books with our kids because the language was just so much more challenging for them, written just, you know, less than a century ago.
Right.
But, you know, now if you get chapter books for your kids, they're a quarter of an inch thick, you know, and large print at that, you know.
Right.
And so things have definitely moved away from that abstract level of thinking that existed previously.
Mm-hmm. And then the final component here is, he says, print intensifies linear rational thinking. There was an interesting quote on page 59. This undermined our willingness to appreciate and accept mystery, a crucial element of faith. Furthermore, because the printed word demands such intense cognitive processing, it tends to atrophy the value of the intuitive and emotional life. And when you think about it, our rational selves sometimes get in the way of our faith, right? They try to make sense of it all. And the printed word is a very academic approach to something that in most cases we have to simply, well, in all cases, we have to believe by faith. You can't think through the crucifixion and resurrection of Christ and the fact that that act paid for the sins of all people. That's a mystery. That's a thing of faith.
Yeah, I'm kind of chuckling to myself because the printed word is linear and rational, except maybe this book. I'm not kidding. No, I'm kidding.
This book is a living proof, I think, right?
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah, it makes your head hurt sometimes. But we get to a point, trust me, Sally, there's a point later in the book where it kind of all comes together. And we do make some application about technology and the use for it in the church. So this is foundational. And unless you kind of get this and understand, you know, the laws of media, the four laws of media, you know, remember we talked about the last time, enhances, reverses into, obsoletes, obsolesces, and retrieves. it does make sense to kind of critically look at everything that we do, whether it is a technology or a practice or whatever, and say, what does this say? You know, not just what are we saying, but what does this say? So interesting stuff. So again, the hidden power of electronic culture. Sally, never fear, we'll have another session where we'll go over chapter 4.
Looking forward to it.
I bet you are. And we'll get to the end of this eventually. So hope you're following along at home. Shall we jump to ministry resources?
Yeah, I'm really excited to share this resource with our listeners this week. I received an email from the Voice listserv, and Voice is a listserv dedicated to those with hearing deficiencies or hard of hearing or deaf, and they're always sharing great resources, particularly sign language resources. And what they shared this week was a link to a YouTube channel that our Wells Deaf and Hard of Hearing committee has put out, and they've posted video of closed caption video of someone doing sign language of the Lord's Prayer and the Apostles' Creed, and they have plans to add more video to this channel as well. So if you have a YouTube or a Google account, you can subscribe to follow their YouTube. You know, someone in your congregation who's deaf or hard of hearing, you might want to share this link with them, or even embed the videos on your own website.
Very good. Yeah. We're going to have to see if we can get this on streams as well. This would be good content to have there. And for people surfing the Wells website, they could find this stuff.
Yeah, that's a great
idea. Excellent. News and tech, we have anything there?
Well, something did come across my desk that I thought was worth mentioning today, and that is an announcement from Google. Our friends at Google have improved their Google Docs platform to now basically be a file storage location. So in addition to having the ability to create and manage documents online, you can also store any type of file on your Google Docs account. The file size limit is 250 meg, and you have 1 gigabyte of free storage, and they charge you only 25 cents a year for an additional gig.
Why bother?
Yeah, exactly. I had to double take on that, but that's what it says, 25 cents per year per additional gig of storage.
Okay.
So it is shareable, it is searchable, and most of the common file formats will even be viewable. Now, I know they're rolling this out over the next couple of weeks. Their Premier accounts have the functionality already activated on them, and if you have just a normal free account with Google Docs, you should see that added to your account in the coming weeks.
So is this going to work the same way as it works now, where you share that space? Right now you share space between Picasa, Gmail, and Google Docs. Is this totally separate, or is this kind of a everything gets it? Because right now you've got like 7 gigs, I think, for Gmail.
Apparently Google Docs is going to be limited.
Parsed out by itself. Okay, that makes sense. Cool. They're trying to catch up right now for on the Windows Live side with Windows, what is it called? Live Explorer, I want to say. They start with 25 gigs, so maybe that's why it's priced the way it is. But that 250 megabyte file size limit, that's helpful because you would sometimes run up against that if you're trying to save up video and such. So good news. Picks of the week, Sally. What do you got?
I love to make my picks.
And
this week, believe it or not, I have a hardware pick. We recently purchased a new wireless keyboard and mouse combination for our church basement. We've been trying to improve the sound system and the projection and that kind of thing in our church basement, and doing some wiring and things to go along with that. And in the course of doing that, we wanted to tuck the computer away out of the way and use a wireless keyboard and mouse to run the computer from a convenient location. Mm-hmm. And so we did some research, and it was a little discouraging, I have to admit. When you start reading reviews and things of wireless technology,
it ain't quite there yet, is it distance?
Yeah,
right,
it's distance, that's right, Martin. Being able to be some feet away from the device that you're trying to communicate with. We went with a Logitech Wave wireless keyboard and mouse combination, and I'll have a link in the show notes to that. And we've been very pleased with it so far. Haven't used it for very long, probably about a month and a half now, but we're able to be probably 6 feet away from the computer that it's communicating with. I will say the keyboard is more reliable than the mouse. The mouse is a little iffy at times. We paid about $80 for the combination, and I guess we'll see how it works, but for now we're really happy with it.
Okay. This isn't going to turn into one of your worst picks of the year, is it?
No, I don't think I'm doing worse picks. No, I'm not doing worse picks next year.
By the way, great news. We got Tony Vincent, who's going to come on the show in a few weeks, right?
That's right. We are so excited to have him help us understand more about handheld technology in the classroom.
Okay. All right. My pick is a software pick, free. By the way, did you mention the price for your Logitech?
Yeah, about $80.
Okay, $80. My pick is called Connectify. As I mentioned, it's free. It's basically your own laptop-based wireless router or hotspot, if you will. So you simply download the software. I think it only works with Windows 7. I thought I heard somewhere that it works with Vista. You may want to try that out. It's free, so it's not going to hurt to try. But it does definitely work on Windows 7 because I've got it running on my laptop. But it makes your laptop into a wireless hotspot so that if you have a wireless device and you're close to my laptop, you'd see my wireless ID pop up. And you'd be, if you had the password, you could connect to it and share my internet connection. A while back, Sally, we had talked about the Verizon MiFi, which takes a wireless broadband card and shares that out. This could act in exactly the same fashion. So if I had a wireless card, or if I had a wired, if my laptop were connected to the internet via wire, I could turn this on, and then if I'm in a meeting or something, anybody else who didn't have a wireless card or a wire to get on the internet could connect to my laptop and share my internet connection. It's all encrypted. There's really no difference. You don't have a lot of the bells and whistles that a regular router has, but so you can't do port forwarding and that kind of stuff. But if you're looking for just the ability to share your wireless connection, Connectify is a good pick.
So all the same things as a MiFi, is that what you called it?
Mm-hmm.
But not the same price. I really love the price of this.
That's right. And I don't know if it'll always stay free, but right now it certainly is. So go and grab it, install it, and it'll work with any laptop with a wireless connection already. So you just have to download it, install it. It takes all of about 2 minutes, and away you go. Pretty intuitive. There's not much documentation with it either, so it kind of runs itself.
Okay.
We have a training session that we'd like to talk about coming up.
That's right, Martin. You and I are collaborating on Final Web for Dummies.
Mm-hmm.
Final Web is our web hosting partner. We have over 450 congregations, schools, and organizations within Wells and ELS that are using Final Web to host their website. And we thought it was about time to put some training together on the topic and give people the opportunity to join in on that. You're going to be doing it in Milwaukee, and I'll be doing it at Martin Luther College in New Ulm, March 9th through 11th. And it's 3 separate days. You can come for one or you can come for all 3, whatever suits your fancy.
Mm-hmm.
And we have all the information available online. You can get registered and find out more about the offerings at a special website we've put together. It's bit.ly/FW4Dummies, and we'll put that link in the show notes.
Yep, and we are efforting to have another one for the good folks in Michigan as well. I think that's probably going to become a reality, and we'll probably do it over in Saginaw at MLS. But look for that early or later this week, potentially, with confirmation of that. And that'll be on that registration form. That was bit.ly/FW4Dummies. I'm looking forward to that. Day one is for beginners. We're just going to go through templates and how to do images and the menuing system and subsites and email management, just the basics. And then we get a little bit more complicated in day two. And then finally for the power users, which day one and day two participants should quickly get their audio, video, widgets, secure internet, intranet usage, analytics, all that good stuff. So I think this is one of the most requested things we've had, and I'm looking forward to meeting our final web users.
Yeah, me too. It should be a fun time for everyone and hopefully a lot of good results from the time we invest together.
Absolutely. Yep. Why not make your website the best it can be if you're a final web user?
I don't think we've mentioned the price yet. $49 for individual days or $129 for all 3 days.
Package deal.
Mm-hmm. And lunch is included, so can't beat it.
And breakfast and snacks. So
that's right.
Free food. No, kind of free. All right. Community feedback.
Well, I love this comment that we got. We heard from Pastor Tim Wagner, and he had listened to one of our recent episodes, episode 110. We mentioned that there was an upgrade to Mozilla Thunderbird, which mm-hmm. is their email software, open source, free, available on the internet from the Mozilla website. And they just released a major upgrade, so they went to version 3.0. Pastor Wagner wrote to tell us that after he installed it, he unfortunately lost functionality for Lightning, which is the Thunderbird add-on for calendaring. Mm-hmm. And he was using that calendaring in a very important way to manage his email releases and things like that. And so he actually found information on the web and had to go through the process of uninstalling Thunderbird 3.0, backing out to Thunderbird 2.0. And that is not good news. Mm-hmm. I understand that. And I had put these notes into our mind map for this show and made a special note because last week in our show, I mentioned a solution for printing your Google Calendar using Thunderbird and Lightning and an add-on called Provider for Google Calendar. Mm-hmm. And that, too, was affected. Since Lightning wasn't working, then you couldn't use Provider for Google Calendar, obviously. And so I was really sad to read that Pastor Wagner had had this problem. And you know, I think he wrote in the comments something like, you know, the lessons learned with open source software.
That's right.
And you can't control a lot of things like this. And, yep. And it's free. And you get what you pay for and that kind of thing. However, yesterday... the Lightning
late breaking
upgrade.
News.
That's right. The Lightning upgrade was released and it works just fine, at least for the functionality that I had been using it for with the Provider for Google Calendar. I'm right back in business using Thunderbird 3.0. So, Pastor Wagner, if you're listening and you're brave enough to give Thunderbird 3 another try, I believe the problems with Lightning have been resolved, and hopefully whatever plugins or whatever you were using should be working again now.
So I'm almost thinking we need to develop some kind of disclaimer that anything we say can't be held against us, that we're just talking here. If you want to do what we recommend, fine. If you do it and something bad happens, don't blame us.
Yeah. it's a fast-breaking
world that we live
slope.
In. Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
And,
what do we know?
Yeah. We always want to adopt the newest and greatest, but
right.
I guess there's something to be said about caution.
That's
I don't know.
Right. Like throwing it to the wind?
Yeah. That's me.
Okay.
Oh, well.
All right. What's the worst that can happen, right?
Well, I think Pastor Wagner maybe experienced
found that.
A little
yes,
bit.
Yes, exactly. Sorry, Tim. All right. Onward and upward.
We also heard from Pastor Phil Huebner, who was listening to our show last week when we talked about reading your Bible and having Bible plans available. And he has some great resources available on his website. He actually uses his blog to communicate a Bible in a year to his congregation. Mm-hmm. So every Monday he releases tips and information and comments on the chapters for the week, and he invites us to check that out there at ctkpalmcoast.wordpress.com, and we'll have a link to that in the show notes.
Good. Thanks for sharing that, Phil. Mm-hmm.
And finally, we heard from our tweeting teacher. He actually shared a link this week via Digo, and that's Mr. Jason Schmidt, who's out at Gethsemane in Omaha, Nebraska, and he shared a link to a blog article about how to embed RSS feeds into HTML web pages, and it's subtitled The Easy Way.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it actually encourages you to use Google Gadgets and create a Google Gadget and use that Google Gadget on your web page. And so if you're interested in giving that a try, we'll have a link in our show notes. And I also added this link to our Wells Tech Wiki page on using RSS feeds so that we can have it there for future reference as well.
Great reminder, wellstechwiki.wells.net. That's where we're collecting a lot of these things that we think might be helpful to other people. So don't be a stranger to that site. And if you've got ideas like that, don't hesitate to add them yourself. We'd love to see that. Is that it for feedback?
I think that'll do it for this week.
Awesome. Next week, we're welcoming Gail Potratz back. We haven't talked to her in like a coon's age.
Yeah, it's been since October, actually. Mm-hmm. And so we're happy to have her joining us again. And she has a lot of great things to share with us, as usual.
Absolutely. We're going to be talking photography in the classroom.
There you go.
And we also have an interview with a couple of a Wells teacher and her father, who is a teacher at, I want to say, UW Stout, is it?
I think that's right.
Someplace up there. Pete and Carrie Schlosser we interviewed, and they have got some neat stuff to share about using the camera in the classroom, multiple uses. So all you teachers will want to tune in next week. They were at the State Teachers Conference and did a presentation on this. So if you missed that, now's your chance to catch up on what they said there. Let's close the show with the music of our friend Mike Wessendorf, his song Be Still from Color Through the Gray. Thanks, everybody, for joining us. Have a blessed week and talk to you next week.
And kingdoms fall, come and see.